when I told my oldest daughter, Nora, she's 5, and I told her I was prepping to speak to our church this weekend, she did like this really sincere face that she does, kind of like this. And she said, huh, sounds easy. And I was like, does it, Nora? Does it sound easy? And then she said, it's kind of like teaching to a dog. And I was like, what? And she was like, I mean, except you're teaching the Bible to a church, but it's kind of like teaching to a dog. So I don't know if you guys should be insulted or, but that is basically my life in a sentence. So we're still in the book of Matthew, but before we go any further tonight, we're just going to recap really quickly last week's message in case you missed it or didn't get a chance to listen to the podcast. But we were in Matthew 10, the very beginning of it last week, and we're introduced to Jesus's 12 apostles. And we learned that this was, in fact, a very diverse group of men. I love that Jesus, from the very beginning, showed us that he has a heart for unity for his followers, but you could never look at this group of disciples and think that Jesus confused that for uniformity. They were not the same. They were very, very different people. And one thing Michael highlighted last week was the reality of two guys specifically, Matthew, the tax collector, and Simon, the zealot. So Matthew, as a tax collector, his job was to go and collect Roman taxes from his fellow Jews. And a lot of the times the tax collectors got super greedy about it, and they kept some of the money for themselves. So people just generally did not like them. Simon, on the other hand, was basically at the total opposite end of the socio-political spectrum. And as what we call a zealot, he probably hated Rome, probably hated being under Roman rule, and likely would have seen it as his duty to honor God using violence against anyone he thought were enemies of God. So these two guys had opposite views on how Israelites should live in a Roman world. It's not just that they wouldn't have been friends. It's not just that they wouldn't have hung out. They were so, so different, and they thought so differently that violence between them probably would have been assumed. But Jesus enters the story and begins to demonstrate that his kingdom was nothing like the kingdom of the world. Rather than coming with force, he came with love. Rather than using violence, he came through serving others. So if Matthew and Simon can follow Jesus together, so can we. If this motley, diverse bunch of disciples could be not only chosen by Jesus, but used of him to partner with him in his earthly ministry and after his resurrection, then there's hope for not only our little church, but like the big C church in the world. So we're going to pick up the story in verse 5 of Matthew 10, and we're going to do something a little different today, which is to read the passage twice and to read it in two different translations. When I found out this was the passage I was going to be teaching on, I'll be honest, it's not one that I look at and think like, oh yeah, yeah, I know what this is saying. There's just some confusing things about it to me. And so one thing I did this week was I listened to it like via audio Bible in my car, just over and over. And it was so helpful to just soak it in. So that's what we're going to do tonight, is just read it in two different translations and just kind of get a feel, get our heads around it before I say anything else about it. So you can follow along on your phone or on the screen, but I'm going to start in the CSB, just the Christian Standard Bible, just because that's the one I have. So picking up in verse 5, Jesus sent out these 12 after giving them instructions. Don't take the road that leads to the Gentiles, and don't enter any Samaritan town. Instead, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. As you go, proclaim, the kingdom of heaven has come near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those with leprosy, drive out demons. Freely you received, freely give. Don't acquire gold, silver, or copper for your money belts. Don't take a traveling bag for the road or an extra shirt, sandals, or a staff, for the worker is worthy of his food. When you enter any town or village, find out who is worthy and stay there until you leave. Greet a household when you enter it And if the household is worthy, let your peace be on it. But if it is unworthy, let your peace return to you. If anyone does not welcome you or listen to your words, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that house or town. Truly, I tell you, it will be more tolerable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. Now let's read it in the NIV. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Do not go among the Gentiles or any town of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. As you go, proclaim this message. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. Freely you have received, freely give. Do not get any gold or silver or copper to take with you in your belts. No bag for the journey or extra shirt or sandals or a staff, for the worker is worth his keep. Whatever town or village you enter, search there for some worthy person and stay at their house until you leave. As you enter the home, give it your greeting. If the home is deserving, let your peace rest on it. If it is not, let your peace return to you. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, leave that home or town and shake the dust off your feet. Truly, I tell you, it will be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. So, going back to verse 5, Jesus is giving them some instructions. I kind of imagine them like all lined up and Jesus kind of pacing back and forth in front of them, like slowly meeting each of their eyes. Or maybe they were sitting around a table when he gave these instructions. That's actually more likely because they spent a lot of time doing that. But any way you slice it, this is Jesus' version of listen up. This is exactly what I want you to do. Here's what you can expect. It was very specific, very direct. I have a three-year-old. His name is Jack. And with three-year-old boys, you have to be very specific and very direct. Oftentimes it means like getting on his eye level with like a hand on his shoulder and saying something like, Jack, I want you to go to your room and get pants. Buddy, go get your pants. And then if he kind of like goes in and comes back, I'm like, buddy, go get your pants. Just very specific, very direct instructions. So this is Jesus leveling with his disciples and giving them what is really their first specific mission. So first, he tells them where and not where to go. He tells them to focus on the lost sheep of the house of Israel. We have this tiny map that's actually kind of too small for you to even see, so I'll just have to do it by colors. But he tells them to, let's see, don't take the roads that lead to the Gentiles and don't enter any Samaritan town. So if they would have gone to the east, like purple area, or the north, that kind of golden area, that was Gentile territory. If they would have gone to the south, kind of light blue, orangish, greenish yellow, those would be Samaritan towns. He says, don't go those directions. Where he wants them to be is that kind of top orangish tan area, that's Galilee. That's what he meant when he said, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I kind of found it almost surprising to hear Jesus tell them not to go to the Gentiles, not to go to the Samaritans, because we know from both God's promises in the Old Testament and the New Testament that God's heart was to eventually restore all nations to himself, not just the Jews. But Jesus is doing something really important here in where he wanted his disciples to begin. It was symbolic of Jesus fulfilling God's promise to use Israel as a tool to bring blessing to the world. Later, Jesus would commission his disciples to go out to all nations. If you skip ahead to Acts 1:8, Jesus says, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth. But not yet. First, start with the people of Israel. This direction just indicates kind of the proper order of how and to whom Jesus's message is to be preached. And the Israelites have long, like hundreds and hundreds of years long, been awaiting their Messiah. They've been awaiting Jesus. So Jesus commissions his disciples to start there by announcing the kingdom of heaven is at hand, or the kingdom of heaven has come near, and pointing to Jesus as the promised Messiah, leaving Israel with like this ongoing decision of will they or won't they accept the message of Jesus. Next, Jesus gives them their message and their mission. Their message is the exact same as Jesus's. The kingdom of heaven is near, or the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's what Jesus has been saying all up to this point in the Gospel of Matthew. So he gives them the exact same message. Go tell the people, the kingdom is at hand. And then he gives them a mission that's just like an exact parallel to his. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those with skin diseases or leprosy, drive out demons. So it's really cool because Jesus has literally just done all of those things. Like you only have to turn a page or two in your Bible and read stories about all of those. So what's cool is that what Jesus is doing by giving them this parallel mission is indicating that now they have not only the authority to go do those things too, but his power in them to do the same things. But here's where he begins to give them kind of some caveats or some things to think about. First, he says, freely you have received, freely give. Like, okay, why is that there? Just kind of like a random specification. I was a little bit confused when I read that, but I read various commentaries and learned a little bit more. That the idea is that Jesus is reminding them that they did not earn his power in them. They did not pay to have his authority. He like gave it to them generously and freely, these ordinary men that he chose. So because they freely received not only Jesus's power and authority, their only option is to give it away freely. They can't go and charge people for healings. They can't go and ask people for money if they're going to do a miracle or signs and wonders. Rather, to give it away for everyone that they encounter out of the generosity and the abundance of Jesus at work in them. And it just made me think about, to put it another way, like, don't be stingy with the power of God. We have no reason to be stingy with the power of God in us. We have every reason to give it away. It's a really specific example, but as I was thinking about it, sometimes when I am in a group or with a friend, praying with someone, praying for someone, sometimes I'll just feel the Spirit like prompt me, like, just lay your hand on them, which is not that out of the ordinary. I do that sometimes anyways. But there's times when I feel like the Lord is like, hey, just lay your hand on them. Like, you don't know how that might minister to them. That might be how the love of the Lord flows through them in this moment. And I just sit on it. And like second guess, like, it's a pandemic. Like, is this a good time to lay hands on people? Or maybe they think it was weird, or we've already been praying for a little bit. That'd be kind of random to like touch them in the middle of the prayer. That's just me getting in my own way. To not be stingy with the power of God would just to be like, okay, Lord, I don't know. I think that's you. Who knows who might benefit from just the blessing of a hand on their shoulder? Let's keep going. Verse 9. Don't acquire gold or silver or copper for your money belts. Don't take a traveling bag for the road or an extra shirt, sandals, or a staff, for the worker is worthy of his food. Again, also confusing for me. Like, why can't they take any stuff? Again, commentaries were really helpful as I studied. The gist of it was this was not going to be an international missions trip. So it's not going to be something that they needed a lot of time or preparation for. They did not need to pack a whole bunch of stuff. They just needed to start. They just needed to go. Not overcomplicate it. They weren't going to need extra money or a neck pillow or travel-sized toiletries or an extra tunic or anything that anyone would take with them on a trip. Then that phrase, the worker is worthy of his food, just means God knows that you're doing ministry for him. He's going to take care of your basic needs. You going out and serving the Lord, doing my work, I know that you need to eat 3 times a day, and I'm going to see to it. You'll get to have your 3 meals a day. Don't worry about anything else. I'm like the last person to stand up here and talk about traveling light ever. I'm like a chronic overpacker, and then we had 3 kids. And I'm convinced that it does not matter if we're going an hour away, 1 night away, or like a full-blown vacation. We just have so much stuff. So much stuff. It's never not an ordeal. That felt like a good double negative use. It's never not an ordeal. It's always stressful, and Michael and I are usually a little mad at each other when we drive away from the house. Like, I don't know. We haven't found a way around it yet, but we're always just, not because we did anything wrong, we're just kind of mad at the whole thing. Like, just whatever. And I like to think that it was because we have kids and kids need stuff, but then I remembered this really vivid, like, mental picture from when Michael and I were first married. We didn't have kids. We got to spend 10 days on the island of Maui for our honeymoon, which was awesome, and I'm ready to go back. But we wanted to be really frugal and smart. We were, like, young. We did not have a ton of money, so the plan was go to Costco when we first got to the island, buy all our own groceries. We could be so smart and not eat out and eat PB&J, which, word to the wise, you don't want to eat PB&J when you're in Hawaii. You want to eat sushi and fish and chips and eat out literally every meal. So anyways, we stock up on groceries. The plan was to stay 7 days at this condo, and then we splurged and got 2 nights at this Westin resort for our last 2 nights. It was a big deal, so we were trying to be cheap with the food situation. Anyways, all that to say, it would have worked great, maybe, if we had stayed at just those 2 places. Long story short, we ended up having to stay 4 different places in our 10 days there. So every couple days, we like repacked and then loaded up our little tiny rental car to go somewhere else, and including all of our groceries. And it was fine when we like moved to the timeshare. We carried all our stuff ourselves. But one of the things that we just made sure to carry everywhere was this box of chips. And it was this box of chips that we bought at Costco. They were called veggie straws. If you know, you know. The zesty ranch flavor is the best flavor. It's not a debate. Anyway, so we took that everywhere, like in our rental car, so we could just have a snack wherever. Anyways, when we showed up to these nicer hotels, it felt kind of cool to like pretend we were rich for a second, but it just all broke down when the bellhop came to help us with our stuff. And there's like luggage, chips, like box of chips being like wheeled through these fancy hotels. But we were like, we're gonna take our food with us. Like we have to take our chips. Anyways, it was just a whole thing every single time that we had to move. And I think we can all agree that our stuff just complicates things. It's simpler to say yes last minute or to start right away when you don't have a bunch of things to worry about. And so it was for the disciples. Eugene Peterson, in his paraphrase, The Message, puts it like this. Don't think you have to put on a fundraising campaign before you start. You don't need a lot of equipment. You are the equipment. And all you need to keep that going is 3 meals a day. Travel light. Another scholar, Stanley Hauerwas, I always say his name wrong, says Jesus' command that the disciples travel light, for example, is necessary to manifest that they have nothing to commend other than Jesus himself. To be a follower of Jesus has not made them wealthy, powerful, or secure. They are charged to have nothing at their disposal other than the authority that they have been given by Jesus. As a result, nothing is allowed to get in the way of the witness they make to the gospel. And then we come to verse 11, where Jesus tells them how to figure out where to stay. And he kind of gives them this specific, not a formula, but listen, you go figure out where to stay. I don't think they knew where they were going to stay, but he tells them how to figure it out. Their instruction was essentially to search out not just genuine hospitality, but those who would welcome them and welcome the message of Jesus. The idea of going to a town, for me, and trying to find someone to stay with is at best uncomfortable and at worst creepy, in my mind. And I think we have a hard time understanding this whole framework just in our American life of suburbs and single-family homes and fences and, you know, just safety and all of that. But hospitality in Middle Eastern ancient culture was not only normal, it was valued. It was really, really important. And you can trace that theme back all the way to the beginning of Scripture. It was actually a really significant thing and marker of how God wanted his people to be. That could be a whole other sermon or series. Anyways, the idea of staying with a stranger was not a new thing to the disciples, but they were instructed to find someone who was worthy, which is an interesting term, which just basically meant find someone who's going to welcome you, welcome my message. So the way they were supposed to do it was to greet a house, probably with some type of blessing, like peace be to you or peace be on this house. If the people received not only the disciples, but the message of Jesus, then God's peace like actually came and rested on the house. This was like an active blessing, like bigger than just a, hi, I'm looking for a place to stay. Actual blessing extended. They receive it, God's peace rests on them. If the people reject it, the peace like bounces back. Jesus says, if they reject it, let my peace return to you. So this analogy probably breaks down somewhere, but I think about it like this. If I send Greta $10 on Venmo or Cash App, I got you. She then can either send it back and be like, I don't need your money, or she can cash it out. It goes to her bank account and she can get coffee or lunch the next day. But it only gets to her if she cashes it out. Otherwise, it's just pointless. And that's kind of how this blessing was. They extend it, the people receive it, it comes upon them. The people reject it, boom, goes back to the disciples. And then, so Jesus warns them about rejection, warns them what to do when they're rejected, and says, if anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, they were to, in the words of modern philosopher Taylor Swift, shake it off. Shake the dust off your feet, which was basically like a physical symbol of disassociation. We like clean our feet when we come inside or something, but this was more significant of like, shake the dust off this town, these people's house. They weren't to stay and like make a scene or argue more, try to prove their point. The instruction was just go somewhere else. And I've always found it so interesting and freeing that Jesus gives the disciples not only a clear expectation of rejection, like, hey, not everyone is going to receive this or receive you, but he gives them permission to move on. And the heart behind Jesus telling his disciples this is that the clock was ticking. The time was limited. Jesus's time to do ministry on the earth with his disciples was short. And Jesus knew that. And so as a way of helping them make the most of their time, he said, don't spend time where you're not welcome. There's gonna be places that do receive me and receive the good news. Just go there. Make the most of your time. Plus, he tells them in verse 15, they weren't going to have to worry about the end judgments for those who rejected Jesus. Verse 15, Jesus says, truly I tell you, it will be more tolerable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town, the town that rejects you. That's really heavy. If you're familiar with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, or if you're not, you can go read about it in Genesis 18 and 19. But it's a story about two cities that were so marked by sin and wickedness, just ongoing evidence of their rejection of God, that God just wipes out both cities by burning, like by raining burning sulfur on them. It's really sad and pretty dark. Jesus tells his disciples it's going to be worse for the Israelites who reject Jesus on the day of judgment. How could it be worse? Why is it going to be worse for them? One commentator suggests this perspective. The preaching of the gospel becomes for Israel a threat as well as a promise. Increased light of God's revelation makes for increased responsibility. And those who have been exposed to Jesus' ministry and the witness of the disciples have greater responsibility for that privilege. The whole scene exudes urgency because the time of Jesus' earthly ministry is short. And both the blessings of the kingdom and the punishment of judgment are awaiting a decision from Israel. So Jesus is reminding them of this solemn but important reality. They can move on from the people who reject Jesus, but Jesus does not. This is not something we talk about often or like to talk about. The reality that there will be one day a very, very real judgment for those who decide to reject the person of Jesus. So, all of this about the disciples' first mission in this really specific place, what, if anything, does this have to do with us today? Some passages in Scripture are very prescriptive, and we can take them as like, it says this, so we do this, and it says this, so we do this. This passage is more of like historical narrative, specific people group at a specific time for a specific place, but I think there are some things in it that are worth considering for us. So I'm just going to give you three. Start where you are, keep it simple, and move on when you need to. Start where you are. I think right now, especially a year into a pandemic, it's really easy to think that we have like few or no ways to do ministry or to serve. Like, what can we do? A lot of things are shut down. Our church isn't doing a whole lot. There's not really anything to sign up for. I think it's easy to wait until the church plans something for us to participate in. But right now, I think the question to ask is, what can we do? What does it look like for you to bring the kingdom of heaven where you are? With our words, our actions, our presence, to bring healing, to bring life, to bring kindness, to bring hope to the spaces that we are in, rather than to focus on the things and the places that we aren't. When was the last time that you wrote an encouragement card and like put it in the mail with a real stamp? Just to speak life or to send a scripture to someone in the middle of the week? Or the last time you brought a meal to someone just because maybe they're having a hard time, but maybe they just came to your mind and you thought, I just want to bless them today. Or invited a neighbor over for dinner. We ran into one of our neighbors the other night on a walk, and she's older and she lives alone, and I just said, how you doing? And she just got like sad. She just said like, I don't do that much. It's just me. I don't have anyone here. I don't really go out. Just with the pandemic, she just stays home. And it's been raining, so she doesn't really go outside. And I could just hear the sadness and loneliness in her voice, and I thought, like, what are we doing? We live right across the street. Like, we can do something about this. We can invite her over for a meal. Who knows if she'll come or if she'd be comfortable, but I just thought, this is so sad. She's all by herself. We can help. Like, we can love her. Maybe if you work remotely, reach out to a coworker and just check in. Or if you get to work in person with people, maybe it just looks like resisting the temptation to participate in common workplace cultures of contempt and criticism, and instead just choose honor and kindness when you talk about people. On a really practical level, if you love the idea of serving our church, one really immediate need, kind of our main one, is our kids' ministry. Right now, we can open our kids' classrooms about 2 Sundays a month. We would love to work towards opening them every single week so that our families can have their kids cared for, come to the service. I just talked to Mark tonight. We're really far off from being able to open our kids' classrooms every week. We just don't have enough volunteers. And at the beginning of our church, when Valley first started, we got a lot of outside help because we wanted all the people in our congregation to be able to come and serve. And then we lost a lot of that help with the pandemic. And so, if you are willing even to serve like once every 5 weeks, or maybe you're vaccinated now and you feel more comfortable, whatever it is, if you're willing at all, we won't like make you change a diaper, but if you can distribute Goldfish crackers and crayons and maybe help a few sharing squabbles or things like that, we really could use the help. That is the main like ministry opportunity that our church has right now. And we really need the help. We also need, every week we have to clean up after church, sanitize different things, wipe down different things. There's a small group of people that do it. If you have the flexibility to stay and help, it would be amazing. These are just small ways that you can help partner with us right now to help our church keep doing more of what we want to do. Or maybe there's a ministry that you want to see happen or somewhere that you want to serve. I encourage you, don't wait until we facilitate it or get more people. Just serve. Maybe you have a heart for foster care. Our church might not, I think that would be amazing, but even if our church doesn't officially partner with a foster care right now, you could still go be a part. So that's what I'm saying, is just start where you are. Secondly, keep it simple. Expanding on Jesus's call for the disciples to travel light and unburdened by excess in their ministry, scholar Stanley Hauerwas says this: all people are created for such joy. Jesus's instructions for the disciples' mission, however, remain true for any understanding of Christian evangelism. Too often, concern for the status of the church tempts some to employ desperate measures to ensure that the church will remain socially significant or at least have a majority of the population. But the church is not called to be significant or large. The church is called to be apostolic. Faithfulness, not numbers or status, should be the characteristic that shapes the witness of the church. Indeed, it may well be the case in our time that God is unburdening the church so that we can again travel light. I'm going to read that again. It may well be the case in our time that God is unburdening the church so that we can again travel light. If that doesn't sound like a total affront to our Americanized version of Christianity, I don't know what does. That statement should make us a little uncomfortable. And I really believe that we have an opportunity right now. I'm not sure that God could unburden our church, like our little specific church, more than he has right now. And I secretly hope he doesn't. I don't really want to be unburdened anymore. We are learning and unlearning and relearning and coming to fresh understanding about what it means to be a church. Coming up on 2 years now, we started in some backyards. And we did that for a summer. And then we transitioned to meeting in this building for one service, kind of just barely getting our feet under us, launched some communities. And then the pandemic happened, and it just felt like the rug got ripped out from under us as a church. And for most churches, I know that's been the case. But it's been unique as a new church plant. But we're here. We're still here by God's grace. And hopefully we'll begin to move back toward normalcy and togetherness and everyone and have more opportunities for relationship building with everyone in our church. But I think one of the big temptations as that happens is going to be to start trying to add things and do more things and start ministries because that's what churches do. And I believe eventually and slowly we absolutely will. But I want to ask this. What if, rather than trying to run towards more programs, we just start by running towards prayer and start by praying that God would help us to be faithful first? A faithful church family who cares for the people that are here and then and our neighbors, like the people that are around us separately, but then maybe just then God would entrust us with more people, more ministry. Let's not give in to the temptation to try to escape or squandered the simplicity of this season. Because I don't think it's always going to be this way. I'm sure someday we'll look back and think, remember when it was just so small and it was one service and all we had was kids ministry? I think there's something to press into in this rather than trying to like create it into this big operation. So let's steward this season of unburdening, the season of simplicity as a church well, and pray that God would help us to be faithful in it. Lastly, I need to wrap this up, is move on when you need to. Jesus gives the disciples permission to move on when they're rejected. And I feel this tension between that and then just like the need for perseverance and endurance in sharing the gospel. You hear the statistic of the average person is going to hear the gospel 7 times before they accept it. But it might not be 7 times from us. So I think it just requires discernment and prayer on our parts to know when to just back off a little bit. If someone has become hostile toward the message of Jesus, it might mean back off from that realm of conversation and just preserve the relationship. Jesus didn't tell us to move on from his mission or even just move on from people altogether as friends, but to use our time well and find people who will be receptive to Jesus, because there's so many out there. I was thinking about, Michael and I spent a lot of time in student ministries before Valley started, high school ministry specifically. And we experienced this all the time with students. There were students who were super receptive, super excited, wanted to be there. We invested a lot of time with them because they wanted more of Jesus. And there were others who maybe weren't super into Jesus, but the heart was just to stay, keep them in the fold and go after them with a heart of invitation and love, kind of like the father in the story of the prodigal son or the parable of the lost sheep, just not to give up on them. But we probably weren't going to be like forcing Jesus conversations or texting whole sermons all the time. And then there were other students who might say something like, please take me off your list. Please do not call me about your camp anymore. And we would respect that and move on. So just knowing in those relationships, when is it time to press in? And when is it time to step back and pray that God would send someone else? You never know. I also know, I feel like we always like harp on the way Christians are using social media. Not necessarily anyone in this church specifically, but as a whole, we're not getting so much better at it yet or winning at it. So I think we can talk about it more. But this might be one really practical example of how it works out. I think sometimes Jesus followers are trying to like get the message of Jesus into places, threads, comments where the people just don't want to hear it. They just don't. They don't care. It's always going to get misconstrued. And I'm not saying that all interaction or dialogue on some social media platform is always unfruitful or unproductive, but maybe a step is like move it to a private message or better, a personal conversation. One pastor I follow online said that whenever he gets like a rude or angry message, rather than just typing back a response, he like opens up his camera and records a little video message and just tells the people, I just want you to see my eyes and my face so I can tell you I really think we agree on more than we disagree. I think we really do want the same thing. We might just have different ideas. And he said it just so often disarms the whole thing. Makes it so much less hostile. I've heard it said that it's really hard to hate someone face to face. It's really hard to hate another person up close, because that's where you get context and stories and relationships. The field is ripe for the harvest, so we don't have to spend time arguing with others who don't want it when we can be redeeming time finding people who do. So I just invite you to close your eyes as the band comes up, and I just want to ask a couple questions and give you a moment to pray. And just ask, Lord, what are you challenging me with tonight? What are you inviting me into? Maybe it's God's gracious invitation to you to just start where you are. In the spaces that you occupy on a daily, weekly basis, what does it look like to bring God's kingdom to those places and spaces? With your life, with your attitude, with your actions, with your words, what does it look like to just start where you are? Or maybe you feel compelled by that challenge to just keep it simple. I invite you to pray for our church in this season, for God's vision and direction, that we would steward this season of simplicity as a new church well. We don't have a bunch of plates that we have to keep spinning right now, or a bunch of things we have to do. We get to figure out how to major in the basic things. Or maybe you've just been used to complicating things and are just coming back to the basics of loving Jesus, loving your neighbor, serving others. And lastly, I just want you to consider if there's anyone that the Lord would have you just move on from for now. A person or someone, a relationship that has become hostile in the name of the gospel. And maybe you just need God's permission to not stop loving them, but to move on for now and to entrust them to Jesus. Pray that the Lord would send other people in their life. But to continue loving them as a friend or a family member. God, I pray for every person here tonight. Pray that you would meet them exactly where they are. Or maybe what you had to say to them tonight was something totally different, something I didn't say, and maybe what you're going to speak most to them is about to happen during worship. So I pray that our ears would be wide open and our hearts would be wide open to what you have for us. I really believe that you have just begun to speak to us tonight. We thank you for our church. We thank you too for your faithfulness to us in this season. Thank you for all the people who are still here. Thank you for the story of Valley and your goodness and kindness to our church. And we just trust you with the future, that you would show us what is ours to do and what is not and when. Teach us what you have for our church, that we're not supposed to be exactly like anyone else. Show us what is ours to do, Lord. And pray these things in your name. Amen.